Good night, Robert.
Good night, Liam.
Good night, Liam.
Good night, kids.
We are joined in the line now by Lawrence Grandprix. He is with Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, which is a Baltimore-based grassroots think tank. And Lawrence, I wonder if we could start by talking about the way that the current struggle in Baltimore is being portrayed in the mainstream media and how that compares to what's actually happening on the ground.
Thank you for having me. I've got to look at USA Today. And just as I had predicted, the headline on USN Today was City on Edge after ruling in Porter trial. And this idea of the city being on edge or on the brink is really great for a national media spectacle, because the idea of this explosion of black rage has been an American political trope ever since, and even before the uprisings of the late 1960s, ever since the notion of slave revolts. So you have this notion of these black masses who have this deep-seated desire to have this kind of violent reaction. That's simply not the case. First of all, lots of folk in the community are confused about the current Freddie Gray trials. The defendants have been separated, so there are six entirely separate trials. There's some confusion about who did what and when things happened. So there just isn't this notion that the trial is the mechanism that the community is viewing all these issues through. Also, the notion that there are these unorganized, angry youth, I think really effaces the nuance and the on-the-ground organizing and coalition building that's been happening in Baltimore. There are actually multiple coalitions of folks who are going to the state capital of Annapolis asking for reforms, the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, which is a major impediment to law enforcement accountability in the state, but also asking for things like resource redistribution, investing in grassroots institutions. There are established entities, but also youth groups and student groups leading protests, but also being involved in the policy process. And that complexity and that sophistication of the advocacy on the ground isn't coming through, because the headline and the clickbait is the possibility for a small minority to have a violent reaction that may destroy property, but not focusing on the systemic racism and systemic violence that's destroying black and brown bodies every day.
Well, let's talk about the situation in Baltimore. What is the context in which the killing of Freddie Gray took place and the culture of the Baltimore Police Department in general?
That's a great question. To understand what happened to Freddie Gray, you have to understand the Gilmore Homes. The Gilmore Homes is a public housing project where Freddie Gray lives. It's in the west side of Baltimore, and it represents the forgotten folks in Baltimore in terms of deep disinvestment in this community. Not even much gentrification in terms of that being a big buzzword, but just deep disinvestment and separation from the economic possibilities of the town. So, of course, the underground economy begins to flourish, and the Baltimore Police Department, as you know, the TV show The Wire indicates, has created a warrior mentality. The drug war incentivized militarization and a adversarial relationship between the communities and the police. And the Baltimore Police Department, it has that reality built upon the legacy of Maryland being a slave state and Baltimore being a majority black city, but also having a large section of the political elite that feels like we have to control these poor people, these poor brown people in the town. So you have a militarized police department, some of which have overt anti-black sentiments, but mostly it's just institutionalized about the way you treat people and the way you arrest them and whether you think they're lying or not when they tell you that they can't breathe, so they need to go to the hospital. And all of these things swirl together with the Freddie Gray incident, which is just one of many people who have died in police custody or died at the hands of police in Baltimore City.
Well, and some of the things that have come out in the Porter trial, even though it has been now declared a mistrial, it was essentially putting the Baltimore Police Department on trial or in front of the public eye and giving scrutiny to some of these practices that have been hidden. And I wonder if you think that will result in any changes.
These practices have been hidden, but the folks who have been doing advocacy work on this stuff, we've known this stuff for a long time. You know, we've known that the police department has these jump outs where they kind of jump out on people and take them down and arrest them. We know that they have this culture of this notion of jailitis, for example, where they just assume that all their prisoners are lying. We know there's this culture of rough rides, which is the term used to, if you have a prisoner who may be resisting arrest or just generally you don't like them, you can drive really quickly and kind of make sharp turns and knock the person around inside the van. And the folks who have been in the community, we all know this. And I think that you're seeing both a local push in terms of the city government to really reform some of these policies and practices. We actually are part of a coalition that had a six-point plan to improve the police, including retraining with racial sort of anti-racism training and changing the incentives to, from increased arrests to increased community relationships. But the big thing we're working on as our group leads a beautiful struggle is this Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which the trial itself shows there are some questions that couldn't be asked. There's a huge waiting period when you can even interview the police officers because they have these extra protections codified into law every time they're even accused of doing anything wrong. So you can't even get the full story out because they have this unique Bill of Rights, which gives them more rights than your average citizen or even your average public employee. So there's going to be a huge movement to get that law changed in the state capitol. And I think that that's where a lot of these revelations can get turned into real change.
So there's a Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights in Maryland?
Yes, there is.
What is that?
In 15 states around the country, after the Supreme Court had a ruling that police officers had a right against self-incrimination. So if they're accused of wrongdoing, your boss can't say, answer my question or I'm going to fire you. Because the Supreme Court ruled that was self-incrimination. And as the court does, they send it back to the states to interpret the law and deal with it. 15 states have passed Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights since that Supreme Court ruling in the 70s. And that addresses the self-incrimination possibility, but also has a ton of extra Kafka-esque provisions, which are designed by the Fraternal Order of Police, who advocated for these laws, to prevent legitimate public accountability when a police officer is accused of a crime. So, for example, the police, when they're accused of wrongdoing, they get punished by the chief. But as many of them do, they can appeal to what's called a trial board. The trial board is just like it sounds like. It's a trial, basically, for the cop. And guess who is on the jury? Other police, because of the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. And so in Maryland, you can't have any non-sworn police officers on that critical internal trial board. You can't even have non-sworn police officers interview a police officer who's accused of wrongdoing. So briefly, for example, if you had an officer accused of sexual harassment, you couldn't bring in an expert in sexual harassment to interview the officer to find out what happened and make an independent determination. Because that's against the law, because of the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. And there are a ton of other genuinely Kafka-esque provisions that produce a chilling effect on even reporting police brutality. You actually have to put in your brutality complaint within 90 days of the incident, have it notarized, and only the victim of brutality or their family member can put in the complaint. And so it's just incredibly Kafka-esque. It passed during a politically vulnerable time in the early 70s. And this template that Maryland produced, the first one in the country, has been copied and pasted to lesser degrees in 15 other states. Maryland has the first, Maryland has the worst, and they are so far beyond best practices in this department that it makes states like Arizona and Louisiana blush when they look at the Maryland Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights.
Wow. And I just want to bring it back to what you talked about is people coming together in unity. One of the things that we heard about during following the death of Freddie Gray and the funeral and the protests was a truce between Crips and Bloods in Baltimore. And that was would normally, I think, by most people be greeted with a great deal of support in that that would necessarily reduce the violence on the streets. But yet the Baltimore police viewed it as a threat against them. And I wonder if you could talk about that gang truce.
Absolutely. So I wasn't directly involved in it, but people who are part of the coalition that LBF works with, a bigger umbrella coalition called Baltimore United for Change, we have connections to folks who have connections with these street organizations. And one of the phrases they used was that given the what they had seen, that for that time, black was going to trump red or blue. which is the gang colors, the Bloods, and the Crips. So this idea of having a genuine unity in the community was really essential to quell some of the potential violence at that time. But unfortunately, police officers live in a bubble, and sometimes that bubble breeds paranoia. So when you view gang members not as people who are a part of a community, not as someone's brother and sister and mother and father, as folks in the advocacy community do, that doesn't excuse what they do, but they are a part of the community. You view them as basically an enemy army, enemy combatants in a war. Then if your two enemies declare a truce, then intuitively you're going to be worried of a potential larger force being leveraged against you. And this stems back to, you know, really some unfortunate incidences in the early 1970s where, you know, members of the Black Liberation Army and different groups, you know, or really fringe elements may have actually had, like, offensive attacks on police officers. But ever since those isolated incidences, there has been this conception that there's a possibility for Black urban youth to become an army and wage war on the cops. And that has been a huge driver in the increased militarization of the police, the development of a warrior mentality within the police departments that says, basically this idea of a thin blue line that gets repeated ad nauseum. And the argument is there's a thin blue line between civilization and the barbarians that are threatening to destroy civilization. And that's the mythology that is embedded into cops all over the country, that it is their thin blue line of cops that prevents the basically barbarians, in this case gang members, from destroying civilization. And you can obviously see the racial undertones within that sort of Manichaean black and white way of seeing the world.
Wow. Bringing it back to the Porter trial, was a hung jury, a mistrial. Is it likely that there will be a new trial against Officer Porter?
From what I've seen, I think there has to be. The idea of putting Porter first was to use him potentially as a material witness against some of the other accused police officers. And they can't do that if there's no ruling in the Porter trial. If there is a ruling, then they can subpoena him for those other trials. And so I think from what I've seen, they have to start from scratch. They have to impanel a new jury, go through the jury vetting and selection process known as voir dire all over again. And I think that there's some possibility of the prosecution pulling out some new arguments and the defense is going to make their case. But I do think there are some things that people need to pay attention to. For example, I imagine the defense is going to say that this mistrial proves the need for a change of venue. And lots of folks in Baltimore are very much against that because they want a Baltimore jury to decide the situation, given this is the Baltimore City Police Department. They want Baltimore members of the Baltimore City community to have a decision over adjudicating what happened in this incident. And so I think there's definitely going to be more legal fireworks to come. I just hope that folks in the media can continue to expand their scope on the issue and see not only the possibility for people to react out of frustration, but all the construction activity and activism being produced out of a desire to build a new coalition for social justice that's come out of this incident.
And at the same time, there is, you talked about the disparities. One of these, I think, is seen clearly in the case of Alan Bullock, who was an 18-year-old teenager who was caught on film breaking the window of a police car and is now facing life in prison. Is that a higher sentence than the officers who were involved in the death of Freddie Gray?
If you're talking life in prison, then yes. There are six officers accused. The only officer who has a murder charge is the van driver, Officer Goodson. And from what I'm seeing, something like 40 years is the maximum for that particular charge from the cops. And I think that just demonstrates this is not about either. Freddie Gray's death was tragic. And the frustration and activism that you see is a call for Freddie Gray to have justice for his death. But it's also a manifestation of this deep, visceral understanding that so many folks in Baltimore have that the system is rigged. It's about excessive bails, millions of dollars for folks to get out on bail, hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's about the nature of pretrial detention for Black folks versus white folks. It's the nature of disproportionate arrests for marijuana distribution versus between black communities and white communities. It's the disinvestment from places like Sandtown, Winchester, where Gilmore Holmes is, where Freddie Gray lives, compared to downtown Baltimore. So there is a legal disparity in that instance, but it's manifestation of this larger issue that Baltimore has been refusing to deal with, is that its structural inability to value black life and a structural nature that is designed to prop up certain neighborhoods and certain people at the expense of the most vulnerable people in that city.
Wow. And again, we will continue to follow this issue as the five other officers face trial as well. We've been speaking with Lawrence Grandprix. He is the director of research for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. It's a Baltimore-based grassroots think tank advancing the public policy interests of black people in Baltimore. Their website, lbsbaltimore.com. Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO Radio.
Thank you so much.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio and Heartbeat Silent Sound Systems proudly presents Silent Nights 2015, a silent disco and silent auction benefit for KBOO, December 19th, 8 p.m. at Manifestation PDX. This very special silent disco features talented KBOO DJs and MCs. You'll have three channels of danceable jams to choose from, including bluegrass, the Grateful Dead, reggae, afrobeat, world music, hip-hop, funk and soul, electronic dance music, bhangra, and global bass music. There's something for everyone. We'll also feature a silent auction with art from local artists as well. Silent Nights will be on Saturday, December 19th from 8 p.m. to midnight at Manifestation PDX, 2020 Southeast Bush Street in Portland. For more information on the lineup and tickets and more, go to KBOO